This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oshita Moore. Familiar name? Doesn't have to be, but it will be after this hour because Oshita is my guest today as the author of Dear White Peacemakers. Isn't that an intriguing title? Made even more so with the subtitle, Dismantling Racism with Grit and Grace. Hold on, white peacemakers. You say, oh no, not another one of those race broadcasts, for crying out loud. I'm so tired of hearing those names and Black Lives Matter, that we got to do this and we can never say this. Hey, well, you know what? You're going to learn more than all of those things if you're going to listen to the show. So here's the challenge. You'll find out whether you are a white peacemaker or not as you listen to Oshita Moore. She's a writer, a pastor, a speaker, a podcaster, and a mother of three, an economic justice advocate for women. And besides that, she's a resident of St. Paul, Minnesota. So how could you possibly go wrong? You can't? So meet Oshita Moore. Hi, Oshita. Welcome to The God Show.
Hi, Pat. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're going to be even happier at the end of the hour, I promise you.
I'm glad.
You seem, though, having read the book, you seem to direct your message primarily to white Christians. Does that mean there aren't any racist Jews?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, you know, first I'd like to just say with your question, I personally have a posture where I don't call anyone a racist. I feel like that word has so much baggage and it's so problematic in us having a dignifying, loving conversation around this really important topic of racial disparity and racial conflict. And so I personally don't call anyone, Jew or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist, a racist. There are people.
What do you call somebody who says vile and insulting and corrupt things to someone based exclusively on the fact that it's a black man or a black woman?
Right. That's a really good question. So as you read in my book, I really root my approach to anti-racism in calling everyone beloved and acknowledging that they are children of God and that they are made in God's image. So when I want to address somebody's behavior, or when I want to identify someone who is exhibiting racist behavior, then I would say that is a person who is struggling with racist ideas, or who has not, or a person who has not come to terms with racism. So it's like a fine kind of nuance. I don't say racist, but I do say, yeah, there are people who are influenced by ideas that propagate that people who have European features are better or should have an easier life than people of color. So
okay, well then let me, Oshita, rephrase the first question. In the book, you do seem to direct most of the messages at white Christians. So do they have more of a problem with racial insensitivity than Jews or Muslims some of the people who espouse and participate in Eastern religions?
No, I don't think I don't think Christians have particularly more of an insensitivity. I think that depending on what tradition you're a part of, if your Christianity is formed in a mostly Western context, you have a little bit more obstacles because a lot of racist ideas have been reinforced through the use of the Bible. And so I do think that Christians just have to be aware of kind of how racist ideas or white supremacist ideas have sort of influenced or been even sanctioned this language around our faith. But I don't think that it's the reason I wrote the book towards white Christians and the reason why I root the book in the teachings of Jesus is just because that's my journey. That's how I conceptualize my work around anti-racism. It's just rooted in the person and ministry and life and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I also know that that's a community that I share a language and a tradition with. And I can say, hey, let's look at the teachings of Jesus that we all hold up and ask ourselves, how are we living in line with these teachings, particularly around this idea of dismantling racism, holding in tension what I see in Jesus' ministry, grit and grace, honesty and truth, but love and belonging and inclusion.
And Jesus would certainly, as far as his teaching is concerned, would go along with that concept in spite of the fact that an awful lot of white Europeans decided to change what Jesus looked like when it came to sculpture and paintings. Isn't it funny that we're talking about a dark Middle Eastern man, and he looks like in most of the artistic presentations of the centuries, he looks like he's Norwegian.
Yeah, and you know what? That is true. And so to kind of piggyback on your first question, I do think that, you know, white Christians do have to do a little more extra work in paying attention to just sort of how they have been introduced to the faith or been taught about Jesus from a very European or white-centric lens, whereas I think maybe our Muslim brothers and sisters or our Jewish brothers and sisters, when they read the Bible, they wouldn't immediately think of Jesus as a Norwegian-looking man, as you put it. They would see Jesus as, you know, an olive-skinned toned man or a dark-skinned man because they see that within their own community and their own faith expression in a way that, like, your predominantly white church may not think of that, because when they go to church and worship with other disciples of Jesus who are reflecting the love of Jesus to them, those people look just like them. And so that is part of the work of dismantling racism, is just paying attention to how are you white peacemakers superimposing European features into the story or onto the person of Jesus, who was a man of color.
Talk to me about growing up, Oshita. Tell me about your family.
Sure. Yeah. So I am from Texas. I'm a very proud Texan. And I originally am from a small town in Texas called Texas City, Texas. It's surrounded by refineries. But we love football, and it's a really great little kind of community to be a part of. I came to faith in an Assembly of God church when I was about 5 years old. And that's where I really did most of my growing in my faith. And I write in the book how precious those mentors to me were, those white peacemakers to me as a brown child, an African-American child in a mostly white church. They reflected the love of Jesus to me in a profound and beautiful way and really made me want to know more about Jesus and devote my life to Jesus. So I spent most of my time in an Assembly of God church, and then as I graduated from high school, I chose to go away to an Assembly of God school. So that's really like where my faith was rooted. My family, my dad is a psychologist, and my mom worked in retail. She was a manager of a couple of retail stores. I kind of joke, I didn't know that women were stay-at-home moms until my youngest sister, who's 14 years younger than me, was born, and my mom was like, you know, I've worked outside the home all my life with being a mother. I want to be home with my last daughter. And so I didn't even know that that was a thing. So most of my life, I grew up with two working parents. My dad worked for the state of Texas. He would receive, for the Children Protective Service, he would receive the kids who were taken from homes and just kind of do some preliminary work with them. But they weren't really, I mean, they were more culturally, they're more cultural Christians. So they, you know, cared about the big holidays, and they, and, you know, we prayed in our home and we talked about faith to some extent, but I was really more excited and really more invested in my faith. And so, so there's that. And then I'm the oldest of four children. So I have two younger sisters and a younger brother, and they're all back in Texas.
Assembly of God's pretty fundamentalist, isn't it?
It can be. Yes, it can be. The Assembly of God is, well, yes, yes. I try to be more nuanced about that because, you know, I think with the Assembly of God, one of the beautiful things that I loved about it was that it was so rooted in trusting the work and movement of the Spirit. And kind of when you go along with that, you know, the Spirit is I feel like the Holy Spirit contextualizes our faith for us. So I've met, you know, Assembly of God churches that are Hispanic. I've met Assembly of God churches that are mostly Asian American. So they're kind of across the spectrum. And then, you know, our faith is not separate from our cultural identity. So you may be a part of an Assembly of God church that will hold some fundamentalist ideas, but also kind of push the boundary around, you know, some other ideas that may not feel as fundamentalist, like, you know, women in leadership or things like that, because it's also rooted in their cultural expression.
Did you grow up around Black families?
That's a really good question. I did not have a whole lot of Black family because I, you know, in Texas City, it's a predominantly white community.
Yes.
Or at least a community that I was a part of. There weren't a whole lot of Black families around us. There were Black kids at my school, but, you know, part of my upbringing is that my dad, you know, he recognized that there were some ways that it would be more difficult for me to thrive in predominantly white settings. If I spoke a certain way or dressed a certain way, and, you know, as I've grown and really embraced who God made me, and that includes being a Black woman, I learned to love Black culture. But as a kid, I wasn't really encouraged to participate in a whole lot of things that you would consider Black culture, which often made me feel like I didn't fit in with a lot of Black families. There weren't a whole lot of Black families for me to get to know, or Black mentors, honestly, for me to learn from. And part of that was just my dad's anxiety in parenting, you know, four brown children, two of whom were going to be girls and would have a little bit of a more difficult time.
Sure. But the book, though, Dear White Peacemakers, by the very nature of the title, is directed, certainly not exclusively, but directed at the white population that you, in the book, continue to at least feel there is hope for, even among those who are racially insensitive, for lack of a better phrase. And I'm wondering if the Black people that you've run into socially, academically, professionally, have you been called whitey?
That's well, no, because most of the white people that I engage with academically, professionally, even my spiritual director, there has been a big swell around acknowledging that there is no one way to be Black. So, you know, so when I talk to other Black leaders, they celebrate me for who I am as a Black woman and the ways that I express my faith and my core convictions and the ways that I use my gifts as a Black woman. There's really none of that kind of name calling or rejection. There is some skepticism, and I acknowledge that there is some healthy skepticism around making space intentionally as a Black woman to invite white Christians, white peacemakers into this conversation, wherever they are in their understanding of of race and dismantling racism. And I understand that skepticism because I think for a lot of Black leaders that I follow and that I learn from, they operate from either a very like academic perspective. So they're like, here are all the things white people you need to know. Like, here's the history. Here's the accuracy, sort of like how we were just talking about Jesus was a brown man. This is what you need to know. And they sort of come at it from, here's all the facts and data and details and history and books you need to read. And I think that we need leaders like that. And I also feel like there are some who have a more prophetic gift. And when I use prophetic, I'm not talking about like casting or speaking about the future, but like calling out and saying, this is wrong. This is not true. This is not in line with our picture of God as loving. And the ways that racism is affecting the brown and Black community, white people, you need to be a part of fixing this problem. And I think there's a lot of people who come out with that posture, and that's their gifting. My gifting is more pastoral. I've always loved sitting with people, listening to hard questions, giving as gracious and as patient as a response as I can, follow up, care, patience, again, you know, that has just been my gifting for as long as I have known that I've been called in the ministry. So to write this book with any other posture other than I want to walk alongside you, I want to be as loving and as kind and as thoughtful and compassionate as I can because I see your humanity, is really rooted in my gifting as a pastor. And so I think that most of the Black leaders that I engage with, they recognize that, they see that. You know, the questions that they ask me are, you know, am I practicing self-care? Am I taking care of myself? Am I setting boundaries? But in terms of like, oh, I'm like a betrayer of my race or quote unquote whitey or anything like that, I haven't really gotten very much of that. And to be honest, Pat, like I know my identity in Christ. I know who I'm made to be. I'm very happy with teaching anti-racism from this posture. So if I got anything like that, I would just pray for that person. Like Jesus says, pray for your enemies and bless those who curse you, and just move on.
But I'm sure you do understand, Oshita, your goals, your quest, your path, the journey that you're taking with this book, Dear White Peacemakers, is beautiful, poetic. It is one of those things that is an ideal that everyone, probably regardless of color, should seek as a method of communication. However, I keep thinking, if you were doing a promotional book appearance in Compton, you lived in Los Angeles for a while, and you know Compton,
yeah,
primarily a powerful Black community, as is,
yes,
Newark, New Jersey, areas of Chicago.
Yes.
If you were appearing at one of those bookstores, what kind of response do you think you would get? And would they listen to your message of love and understanding?
So, you know, you're right in that this book is directed towards a white audience. So I wouldn't really make it my goal to get this book, you know, in a bookstore in Compton and somehow persuade a Black community to learn from me and my particular way of teaching anti-racism. I deeply trust every Black leader who has done their work, and particularly Black leaders of faith who have done, who spent time in prayer and with their mentors to know how they're gifted and to lead from that place. And so one of the things I say in the book is, you know, if my particular approach to anti-racism speaks to you, white peacemaker, and you learn from me, great. Continue learning from me. I'm happy to walk alongside you. But try not to prescribe my message to another leader saying, why can't you be more like Oshita Moore? Because like I just said, we need all three aspects. We need the professors and the prophets and the pastors. If I were to be at a panel discussion or do a book event in a bookstore in Compton, my main goal would want to be to pull a professor in, to pull a prophetic voice in, and the three of us have a conversation towards a wide audience of how you can be a well-rounded ally, how you can do the work from all aspects, knowing that your soul and your self is cared for, that pastoral piece, knowing what is true and right and in line with what we see in scripture, that prophetic piece, and knowing accurate history and being not afraid of learning, that's the professor piece. So that will be my goal if I ever did something in a predominantly Black community, to work in concert with each other to serve our white counterparts.
I wish, Oshita, that I could take some kind of credit for the fact that in reality, I've never been able to understand racial bias. And I wish that I could stand tall, although that's very difficult for me anyway, but to stand tall morally, culturally, and saying, I've made my decision. Well, actually, it's because I grew up in a society and in a in an arena of such diversity that I didn't know any better. I just simply, it never occurred to me that there would be people who felt very different until I lived in the South for a while and I saw signs as a child that said, white only drinking fountain.
Mm-hmm.
Or restrooms that said no colored. And I asked my mom because I found it to be a peculiarity. I didn't understand that at all. Why is it, and I'm sure you must have studied this and come to a conclusion, why is it that this kind of separation, where it does exist, that is in a community, seems to exist in every community? I would love to know that there is some community somewhere, and I'm talking about some community of size, some culture, some country, where even if there are only a few Black people, that they aren't treated differently. Is there any place where there is absolute equality?
Well, I would say within North America, probably not.
No. I mean, we know the problems here, but I'm talking about Denmark or anywhere in Asia. I mean, for crying out loud, even in South Africa, when the Dutch and the German communities moved in to invest in those lands, suddenly the white people who moved from Europe into Africa in order to improve their lot agriculturally and with investment, they became the white supremacists of those areas, even though it was Africa.
Well, I think that's rooted in a lot of things. I think primarily one of the things that I have noticed is colonization, the sending of European explorers to other places to find resources, to find land, is really where we kind of see white supremacy reinforce and spread. Because honestly, when I think of one of the major obstacles that we have to deal with when we think about dismantling racism, is separating ourselves from our possessions and acknowledging our need for more, acknowledging our need for, like, just because a lot of white supremacy was spread because of just this sense of, like, claiming more land, having more resources, having another country that is under your leadership, extending your power. It's a power dynamic. So, you know, I think that you're right. Where one of the things that we see is that when a European settler would move into a predominantly place where there are people of color already there, they would create a colony. And, you know, at that time, that was thought, that was the thing to do, you know, and that was, and that is something that we see even in scripture. So it's not like this was only a, like a European thing. This constant need for more and more and more, take more land, we even see that in scripture. But I think that this particular divide between white people and people of color really, really began with this, with the colonization. And so, yeah, so that is something that when I, when we talk about race, it really is important for us to have accurate and clear history that, you know, we celebrate Christopher Columbus. And we used to celebrate Christopher Columbus Day. And that was, yeah, and that was like, oh, yay, he came and found America. Wonderful. But actually, he was a European colonist who found this group, this land, dispelled a group of people from their sacred land, and set up a colony, and set up a colony, and set up, and took resources. And that is really why white supremacy is something we need to be very, very aware of and actively dismantle, because there's so much loss, so much death, so much suffering tied into these ideas.
But he did. He and the Columbus crew on the three ships and those that followed also were gracious enough to leave the gift of syphilis among the original tribes.
And, you know, and that's true. And so I think that, yeah, to answer your question, was there a utopic, you know, place where there is no, where there aren't these dynamics? I don't believe so. I don't believe on this earth there are places like that. Now, if I've never seen it, I'm not as well traveled as you are, Pat. So I have not seen it. What I have seen in every multiracial space that I've been in is that in order for trust to be built between people of color and the white peacemakers in that space, is for us to have honest conversations about how racial dynamics influence our relationship with each other, because one of the things I talk about in the book is white supremacy wasn't just an idea that happened and it was kind of just passed down at kitchen tables where white families talked disparagingly about people of color, although that is probably a dynamic that has happened. What often happens is white supremacist ideas or racist ideas became laws and became policies and became it influenced procedures, and it just kind of like worked its way into our culture in all these ways that we don't even realize. And so part of my calling as a peacemaker and what I invite white peacemakers into is to be brave enough to look at something and say, oh, there could be some racial dynamics going on here because of white supremacy. So let's be brave enough to like explore that and talk about it. And that's why I root my book in belovedness, because when you are rooted in your belovedness and know that you are made in the image of God and that you are worthy of dignity and love, you're brave enough to have hard conversations, because those conversations don't change who you are as a person.
Oshita Moore is the author of a book called Dear White Peacemakers. And would you not describe the book as a lesson in love?
Oh, I hope it's a lesson in love, but I think it's more just, I mean, I hope it is a lesson in love, because I wrote the book from a place of love. So I sometimes say it's a collection of love letters to my white brothers and sisters.
Is there a love letter that you've written to the Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul Police Department, considering the experiences that have recently taken place there and have been all over the news? How do you forgive sins against blacks by white citizens without uniforms and those with badges?
That's a really good question. So forgiveness is a tricky thing, and I write about that in the book, because forgiveness is not reconciliation. Those are two different ideas for me. I can forgive someone because I choose to create what I call a better story in my mind. In my first book, I talk about this practice of choosing or telling a better story. So when I look at something like Amber Geiger, who shot Botham Jean in his home while he was eating ice cream. When I look at her, I choose to think of a story about what happened in this woman's life that would get her to a place of such fear and such and such callousness to shoot a black person upon sight. What were her experiences? What was her last 24 hours like of exhaustion, maybe? Or, you know, what has she been taught as a police officer, as a woman, a white woman, and relating to potential black suspects? So I do that work, that first work of crafting a backstory for white people who do harm to people of color, and particularly who do harm to my black and brown brothers and sisters, because, again, I do this work because I believe every single person on this planet is loved by God. And if God loves them as a follower of Jesus, I should love them too. So I do that first work. And that helps me access a place of empathy where I can forgive them insofar as I can say, yeah, you know, if not for the grace of God, there go I. You know, if not for the grace of God, my prejudices and my biases could cause me to harm another person. So that's what forgiveness looks like in my heart. Now, systemically, when we talk about like forgiveness, I think, you know, we look at the hug between Amber Geiger and Botham's brother, Brandt, and we think, oh, that's forgiveness. That is what we want. And actually, I don't think that's what forgiveness is. That next step is reconciliation, where we actually have some conversations about what Amber went through, how the Dallas Police Department teaches and trains and prepares their police officers. What are the biases? What, you know, how is conversations around race? How are they, if at all, within that police department? That's where we have those kind of conversations to do systemic change so that there can be reconciliation. So for me, I forgive because I have been forgiven by God. And I say, you know, I recognize that she's a human being and she makes mistakes. I forgive her. The next step for me then is to pray for reconciliation, pray for restoration, pray for restitution, so that that community is restored.
There are thousands of people right now listening to this broadcast, all of whom are saying, almost as a chorus, "Oh, Shada Moore, you're a better human being than I am." Because they're hearing you talk about praying for someone who committed a hate crime, who understands the origins of that problem, who logically looks at these kinds of things and doesn't feel hate in her heart. Is there never a moment when you get angry at the headlines?
Oh, I always get angry. No, I don't think that peacemaking and love of others is antithetical to honest lament and heartbreak and anger and frustration. Those two things can live in tension, and that is actually something that I pay attention to and that I work on. So when I am angry, you know, I take that anger to safe places and safe people to process that anger. So I have trusted friends who I will call and just say everything that's on my mind about how I feel about that thing that happened. Because, you know, we have learned from Richard Rohr, if we, you know, we can transmit our pain to one another if we don't allow it to be transformed. And so I have spaces for pain transformation, like with my therapist, my pastor, my friends, where I am angry, where I am sad, where I cry, and I work through those in a space that I know that is safe and that those people can hold it, and those spaces can help transform that pain out of this retributive thing, which I write about in the book. You know, the violence of white supremacy affects not just white people, but people of color too, at least for me, where I can, if I don't do that work of working through those negative emotions, that those rightful, valid negative emotions caused by racism, if I don't work through those, it can get on the inside of me and it'll transform on the inside of me into retributive anger or retributive violence or bitterness And that doesn't look like Jesus to me. So I actually have to do the work of acknowledging my pain and transforming it in a healthy place. So that then that pain turns to passion, passion for peacemaking, passion for unity, passion for belovedness. And then I can go out and just do this next work of loving those and believing the best of those who do horrible things, like the McMichael brothers who shot Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. You know, I look at them and they look like people who have mentored me, people who have loved me in the faith. These look like they're a father and son, a white father and son from the South. I have seen people like them my whole life, and I don't want to cultivate a posture within me that turns them into devils or demons because they're beloved. They did something horrible, and they have to suffer the consequences of those actions 100%. And those systems need to be changed. But because they did something horrible doesn't change their belovedness. Like Bryan Stevenson says, we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done.
The writer, pastor, speaker, podcaster, Oshita Moore. Have you ever been a protester? You ever walk with a sign in downtown Minneapolis?
I have, and my children have. And in the book, I talk about one particular protest where I looked around and saw all these white peacemakers coming out and speaking out against racism. And I was hopeful, but also wanted to write this book to them to help them stay in this work. So, yeah, I love protesting as long as we're protesting towards a goal of peace and peacemaking.
What do you have to say to the protesters? And it appears, at least in the news, as if they are almost all black protesters breaking into mm-hmm. stores and looting.
Mm. Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that we, and this is a really good question, because I think that if you have no experience with this topic, or you've never seen, you've never been a part of a protest, you can look at the coverage on the news and say, oh my gosh, it's just devolved. There's nothing positive, nothing good is happening. They're tearing up the communities, so forth and so on. And I can understand why you would look at that. I think oftentimes a couple things that you have to keep in mind is the news is affected by white supremacy, and the sensational idea sometimes is to promote a black community as all violence, as all dangerous. And so, you know, that looks a whole lot more compelling if they can find an instance of, which is maybe like 1% of what happens at a protest. You might see some looting. If they can find coverage of that, of course they'll share that, because that'll run really well on the nightly news. So you just kind of have to have a critical eye first and saying, well, they're showing this to me, but they're not showing me any other images of black and brown people peacefully protesting. Then maybe I'd need to hold this news lightly. The other thing I would say is, you know, there are people who will come into a community when there's a protest just to loot, just to cause problems. And so you might even want to ask yourself, okay, are these people who were actually protesting, or are these people who are just coming in because there's a continuation of disruption or in that community by propagating an idea of that only protesters of color are looting and stealing. And then the last thing I would say, and this is something that I learned when my husband and I did urban core work in New Orleans. We lived in New Orleans in a neighborhood known for its gang violence and underperforming school. You know, there are systemic things. There are things that happen in a community that is ravaged by poverty, where oftentimes there is a survival instinct that a lot of these kids, you know, deal with. They live just in this heightened sense of lack. And so sometimes, you know, that sense of lack can manifest in anger, can manifest in frustration, can manifest in disrespect. And so that's why I've built a lot of compassion for the kids that we would work at, because I would recognize, wow, you have always felt like you were behind the eight ball and that you didn't have enough. And so, you know, one thing that we can do is, if we look at looting and it's a legitimate, you know, like it's a community of kids who are looting, instead of villainizing them and saying they're thieves, they're horrible, they're dangerous, they're tearing up their community, asking ourselves, what is causing them to take advantage of this moment to get something that they've maybe never had or that they need? And how can we have grace and empathy for that? And then how can we be brave enough to step in that community and say, how can our church or how can we partner with the leaders already there to create more resources and opportunities for these kids so that they don't feel the need to rob or to do horrible things to have some of their needs or wants met?
Early in this program, you told us about growing up in the family, Assembly of God activists, and your mom and dad, your brothers and sisters. Tell us about your family, your husband and the kids.
Yeah. So my husband and I met in New Orleans doing urban core work. We met, I like to joke that, like, depending on who I'm talking to, I'll say, oh, we met during Mardi Gras, and I'll just, like, stop there and see how they respond. Because typically they'll think, oh, he was, like, throwing beads at her, and that's how they fell in love. Like, their eyes met while she caught the beads. No, we met doing street ministry in New Orleans. And we were there until Hurricane Katrina happened. My husband is a white man, and he has always been passionate about multicultural church settings and urban work. And so when we met and we decided to be together and to be in ministry together, talking about race, talking about living multiculturally, celebrating cultures, that was from the very beginning a part of our family ethos because that mattered to us. We wanted to raise our children to not just identify as black or white, but to identify as black and white and to love both aspects of their identity. And because of that, we learned so much from our Asian American brothers and sisters, our indigenous brothers and sisters, our Latino brothers and sisters across the spectrum. It has helped us be really humble and learn from others. And that's why I write in the book, I'm constantly learning and growing around these concepts of race and identity. And so then I have three teenagers. My oldest is 19. My next is 16 years old. And then my youngest is 15. And they're great. They're funny, funky kids who care about justice. And we live in St. Paul, Minnesota with our dog and our two cats now. We got a pandemic kitten for my daughter. So.
Good. It was a sweet gesture. I want to know, because as I told you a while back, one of the biggest problems that I have with these conversations is not understanding where the violence comes from and why the idea of one color being superior to another one, or the origins of that. We've been talking about that. But now that you have told us about your family, let me ask you, have you never had anybody, as you walked as a couple in St. Paul or in any of the other communities that you've lived in, have you never had a black woman come up to you and say, hey, Sister Oreo, couldn't you find a black man that was worthy of your time?
I have not had that particular instance. I have had instances when I was a little girl, because my maiden name is Whitney. I did have lots of instances of being called Oshita Whitney by other black kids. And I write a little bit about that in the book too. It's just sort of like how I came to terms with my identity as a black woman. I would say this day and age, to be honest, to be an interracial couple is not super, super noticeable. And if people do have opinions, they tend to keep their opinions to themselves.
Well, it isn't super noticeable, Oshita. It isn't super noticeable, perhaps, where you live in St. Paul. But if you were in one of the neighborhoods in Chicago, there would be a lot of comments as people passed by you and could possibly threaten you. There's violence right in those areas, and some of it would be directed at you just because you married Whitey.
Right. So there's a story that I talk about. My husband and I take our kids to this camp, this beautiful cabin on a campground in northern Minnesota, and I was racially intimidated by some men in a truck with a Confederate flag. Which can you imagine a Confederate flag here in Minnesota? Like, that's not even about a heritage. Why? I can understand they're flying
no,
that.
They're everywhere. But, no, they're everywhere.
Right. And you know, so when we go camping or when we go to that cabin, oh, for sure, we stick out. Nobody ever says anything to us. But, you know, to answer your question, it is something that we recognize as a family. And we do have conversations about, oh, we stick out, or, oh, people are looking, mostly when we go up to northern Minnesota, or I took my kids on a civil rights tour down south last spring, where we visited important places, historic places on the civil rights in the civil rights movement, and we were in a lot of places in the South where, you know, we kind of stuck out, or there weren't very many people of color, and yeah, so that is something that I deal with, but I haven't had to deal with it directly, like somebody saying something to me, oh, why are you with a white guy? And also, one of the things that I love about my husband is he cares so much about being a white peacemaker that he listens and learns from people of color, and he's so deferential to people of color that, you know, if somebody were to say something to us like that, you know, he would one, defend me and say, like, well, you know, like, we love who we love, but he would also say, like, help me understand more about that impulse, or, yeah, you know, like, we recognize that there is a disparity, or just like there are more black men in jails, and so a lot of women of color will choose to be single instead of dating a white man. Let's talk about that. My husband is very, very curious about these pain points for people of color.
We were just looking at a picture of your family. Lovely group of people.
Thank you.
And I would imagine that the kids also appreciate the fact, or will appreciate the fact at some point, that they're growing up in a community that has the educational standards that St. Paul has, that the Twin Cities have, and that is pretty solid economically in this period of time. But I would like you, if you don't mind, please, and if you do mind, do it anyway. we only have about 3.5 minutes left. You are now speaking to people all over the world of this international broadcast, but I want you to pick a neighborhood that is almost totally black, somewhere in the United States, wherever. And I want you to speak to a citizen who's listening right now, who feels that nothing will ever change when it comes to white hatred of blacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say to them, you know, I get it. I am a black woman who has been in mostly white spaces all my life, and I have had to feel mistrusted and not enough and in danger sometimes. Just a couple of days ago, I experienced that, and it's heartbreaking, and it's angering, and it's wrong, and what I can say is that that's not God's dream for us. This is the God show, where I hope that we have talked about a picture of God that looks like Jesus, who loved those on the margins, who elevated those who, as Howard Thurman says, are the disinherited. And Jesus recognizes our suffering, and he got in the midst of suffering, and he's in the midst of our suffering right now, and he sees you. And we are beloved, and we are black, and we are beautiful, and God didn't make a mistake in giving us our particular skin tone. And what I would say is to do your best to take care of yourself, take care of your body, take care of your health. Do your best to take care of your soul. Find a community of people who can hold you when you're heartbroken, who can celebrate with you the joys of being black, and who can remind you that we are human. We are not 3/4. We are not less than, we are human. And allow yourself to feel fully human. And if you can, if there are white people that you trust, invite them into this conversation and allow them to learn from you if you can, or invite them to learn so that you can have somebody that's an ally, that when things happen in the news by white people that anger you, you have the Holy Spirit reminding you, oh, but there's Sister Susan who's always faithful and showing up and who will hold space for you. There are white people in my life that I think of when I see something horrible in the news enacted by white people. I'm reminded of the white people in my life, the white peacemakers in my life. So the last thing I would say to a black person who's suffering is find a white peacemaker, pray for them, and invite them in. Because I believe that this work can only be fully done if we find ways to do it together.
And if you wanted to know what the message would be for white peacemakers, it's in the book, Dear White Peacemaker, by Oshita Moore. And aren't you glad you met her on The God Show? This is Pat McMahon.